I'm W.S. Thackeray. I'm interviewing Lieutenant Colonel J.D. Baird, DSO, Royal Canadian Artillery. That's the 17th of June, 1980.
Okay, sir, if you would tell us, would you tell us when you were born to begin with, your age, your birth date?
June 28th, 1907.
Okay,
Red Deer, Alberta.
Okay, that's fine. When did you start with your military career?
In the 1920s, I served for 5 years with the 61st Battery Canadian Field Artillery, non-permanent force at Edmonton, as a bombardier artillery specialist, battery commander's assistant. These were the days of the horse artillery, 18-pounders.
Right. Go ahead.
The day after Labor Day in September 1939, on the declaration of war against Germany, I joined the 91st Field Battery in Calgary as a gunner, being granted leave with pay differential from the city of Calgary. On my first payday in the Army, the parsimonious pay corps deducted the amount I had received from the city of Calgary on account that one cannot receive pay for two jobs when employed by the Queen.
Oh, really?
This was the beginning of the learning process of the soldiers on active service, that our Canadian government used any and all devices to save money at the expense of the serving soldier. The 91st Battery was amalgamated with the 111th of Trail BC to form the 91st 111th Battery. At that time, the regiment was two batteries of six troops each. Before Christmas 1939, the battery moved to Edmonton, and rumor had it we would form one of the three regiments for the 1st Canadian Division. By this time, I had acquired two stripes and a severe case of flu. We had an epidemic of a very severe type, over 50% of all ranks down with it. Living conditions were very crowded, awaiting the construction of new barracks.
Where were you living in Edmonton?
This was out at the armories in the...
So you just bunked down in the main armory?
On the floor and down in the basement.
What sort of equipment were you given at that point?
We had such
uniforms and weapons and...
We had the old uniforms with the putties and spurs and bandoliers.
Mm-hmm.
And the guns we had were the old 18-pounders and 4.5 howitzers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We had no new equipment of any description.
Okay.
At this time of the flu epidemic, we had our first introduction to sulfanilamide, which was the only drug of any value at that time for infections. In the spring of 1940, we were moved to Shiloh near Brandon and were formed into the 6th Field Regiment of three batteries. This regiment became a part of the 2nd Canadian Infantry Division. And here again we had 18-pounders and 4.5 howitzers used in the First World War. I had now attained the rank of Sergeant Major Class 3, a new rank for artillery specialist who also commanded a troop, with the other troop under a lieutenant. Training proceeded at a heavy pace, and much map reading and night schemes were used. The night schemes were highlighted by many cases of poison ivy infections. Late in the summer, the regiment moved east without me as I was promoted to second lieutenant and became a gunnery instructor for recent graduates from Kingston and other officer cadets in training.
Can I just interrupt you for a sec? When you got to Shiloh, what sort of... motor transport did you have at that time?
We had
rid of your horses, obviously. You know.
We just had civilian trucks of all natures and sizes.
You towed the guns by...
Sometimes attaching them by ropes to the back of the truck.
It must have been a bit of a ticklish operation, eh?
Well, it was
going downhill.
Well, sometimes the gun got down there first. And we had the odd truck overturned by the weight of the gun.
Yeah.
In the late fall of 1940, I was transferred to the School of Artillery at Fort Osborne, Winnipeg. 1940-41 was a severe winter, and our clothing was inadequate for the climate. Route marches were, in fact, quite dangerous to many. We finally received the first issue of battle dress, the only issue of good woolen British material. In late 1940, I was granted my commission as a one-pip wonder and had to turn in my new battle dress and purchase one of the new shoddy Canadian issue. The next day, I saw the quartermaster wearing my lovely battle dress, British issue. Having now become an officer in the gentleman by Act of Parliament, it was necessary to write to my dad and uncle for help in purchasing the clothing and equipment required for this new status.
No clothing allowance was given you, eh? Mm-hmm.
Very inadequate. It just paid for a greatcoat.
Mm-hmm.
Long hours of the rule at Fort Osborne for the instructors. In 1941, Lieutenant Colonel Cormack took over command and at this time was appointed commanding officer of the newly formed 17th Canadian Field Regiment. I had become a full lieutenant and accepted the offer of Colonel Cormack to transfer to the new regiment. On arrival at Petawawa to join the regiment, we found a new commanding officer in charge, Lieutenant Colonel Thackeray. After a month of commanding a troop, three of us were promoted to captain. Coins were tossed for seniority of appointment. I came in second, which in the event cost me over 6 months seniority as a major.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Colonel Thackeray was a fine officer and insisted and instituted a varied and extensive course of training for all ranks and all formations. Officers had to qualify in practically every trade and grade in field artillery, driving every type of vehicle, including motorcycle, radio, operation, gun laying, artillery board, etc. In the fall of 1941, the regiment proceeded overseas without our heartbroken Colonel Thackeray. The second command, Major H.E. Brown, was an acting commanding officer for the trip. We sailed from Halifax on the motor vessel Oranzi, an air-conditioned ship with very little heating units.
Hello. Right.
Our route in the foulest of weather was north of Iceland. It's a cold, seasick voyage for many of our people, and it was for me a glorious and happy moment when on a fine, clear morning I saw Scotland for the first time. We traveled down the coast through the Irish Sea and landed in a miserable rain at Liverpool. We moved off the Oranzi and straight onto a troop train, which immediately left for Aldershot, where we occupied the Royal Horse Artillery Barracks. Our new commanding officer was Lieutenant Colonel Landers, whose main interest was to make the 17th Field the best turned out unit of the Canadian Army. This, of course, included the appearance of our guns, equipment, and vehicles. Practical training had a lower priority. I became battery captain of the 76th Battery, and in 1942 was in command on detached duty at Hove, near Brighton, prepared to repel the imminent threat of invasion. I think we had about 10 rounds per gun and 30 rounds per rifle. After the successful Battle of Britain with the skies, we rejoined the regiment and embarked on various exercises, firing practices, and schemes all most beneficial. These culminated in the large Spartan exercise in the fall of 1942, which demonstrated the inefficiency of the Canadian Army at all levels above regimental level. In particular, supply services were grossly inadequate to the extent that we actually ran out of the supply of petrol and rations. It was a shocking revelation and proved disastrous to the careers of many senior officers. On this exercise, while spelling off a dispatch rider, I was injured when I went, pardon me, when I met an English lorry head-on in a narrow lane. Instinctively, I steered right and became a casualty, not by virtue of an umpire. On release from hospital and following convalescence, I was posted to number 2 artillery training unit as a gunny instructor. Boards of inquiry, courts martials, etc., were of monotonous regularity. In early 1943, I was promoted to major and posted to the 13th Canadian Field Regiment. The commanding officer was Lieutenant Colonel Ziegler, and I was given command of the 22nd Field Battery and Alberta Unit. We were based at Billingshurst. Training was very intense and thorough for all ranks. Many courses were attended, and I even had the privilege of attending a qualifying course for field rank in the Royal Armored Corps. I was high up in the class standings.
What was the object of that exercise at the time?
Which exercise?
Going to Armored Corps.
It was a mistake.
Oh?
A staff mistake.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, General Moncel, when he inspected the class at the end of the course, was extremely annoyed that a Canadian gunner had got in on his course because he didn't have enough course to look after his own people.
This would have stood you in good stead, I presume, when you became FP artillery.
Well, yes, it did. Yeah. And on top of that, following this course, I was made senior umpire of an exercise of 3 armored regiments, Canadian regiments, the Calgary Tanks and the 3 Rivers Regiment and the Ontario Regiment. And unbeknownst to me, I gave the highest marks to the Calgary Tank Regiment, and they were picked for the raid on Dieppe, so that I was responsible for them going there.
Yeah, yeah.
They all had the Churchill tanks with a little 2-pounder gun on them.
Yeah, okay.
In the late summer of 1943, I took the advance party to Inverary for our induction in combined operations. We were housed on the Duke of Argyll's estate on Loch Fyne. It is here that we demonstrated for the first time the feasibility of firing field artillery from the sea onto the beach. All the chair-bound experts said it couldn't be done. They were very negative about it all. Finally, through our CRAC, Brigadier P.A.S. Todd, the Prime Minister Churchill got wind of our experiments and ordered complete cooperation and full speed ahead. We successfully demonstrated our methods with vehicles, radios, and guns all embarked on LCTs, landing craft tanks. And we were able to achieve an accuracy of 300 yards with very crude instruments available at that time. On completion of this arduous training, which included every man having to swim fully clothed for a minimum of 50 yards, we went south to our new billets at Bournemouth. Here we went on endless waterborne firing schemes working out of Poole Harbor. Some of these waterborne exercises lasted a full week. The last big one in November 1943 was held in the most appalling weather conditions. We also, during the fall and winter, engaged in training at Lark Hill and anti-tank areas.
Just to interrupt a moment here, what equipment were you using in the way of guns when you were firing from these LCTs?
The regular field artillery, 25 pounders.
How did you fasten them to the deck? How did you take care of recoil and that sort of thing?
The wheels were lashed to deck. We had special bolts
mm-hmm.
put in the deck and with a cable, U-shaped cable to hold the gun down, because we still had to be able to move the trail slightly to make a final correction, because you can't always get your landing craft tank lined up exactly. But we had no difficulty. The big secret of all this is that you must have guns which have variable charges, so that you use your minimum charge for your various ranges to keep the recoil down as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And also, of course, the explosive effect of the charge is kept as low as you can.
So fixed ammunition wouldn't have been nearly as effective then at all.
It would have been quite impossible.
Yeah.
Because,
mm-hmm.
first of all, you wouldn't be able to get your gun elevated high enough at your close ranges.
At close ranges?
No.
Oh, yeah.
You'd blow the end of your landing craft off. So you must have variable charges.
Mm-hmm. And there was no damage to the guns and because of this peculiar setup at all?
None whatever.
No.
There's no damage to the radios. We always covered the radios with blankets and so on to keep off the concussion effect on them. And, of course, we only had enough vehicles aboard all these craft, just enough for the first day of fighting. There was no extraneous stuff.
Just enough to get the vehicles, get the guns off the...
And enough to get your parties. Yeah. You know, most people walked.
It's an interesting loading exercise to load those, have the guns so they would fire forward and then have to turn them around so they'd be towed out or off the vehicle or off the boat.
Well, of course, in the event we used self-propelled guns.
Oh, yeah, finally, yeah, but at this point you were...
At that point you had to manhandle your gun off down the ramp and then your tractor would fall.
And move around in front of it so that it could pick up the trail, huh?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
Early in December, Lieutenant Colonel F.T. Clifford took over command of the regiment. On the 28th of February, 1944, Montgomery held a meeting for all Royal Canadian Artillery officers in Bournemouth, in the theater. And our final two exercises in preparation for the invasion of Europe were held 2nd and of March and the 2nd of April, 1944. It is interesting to note that this last assault practice on the 2nd of April, 1944, and a short one a week later, were conducted out of the concentration area at Parkgate, Hampshire. His Majesty the King inspected the regiment on the 25th of April. One exercise called Vidi Push on the 28th of November, we were later to remember very well because the salient features, including dummy buildings and structures, exits from the beach, etc., were almost identical to what we encountered on D-Day. Hmm. Around the middle of May, the regiment was cut off from the rest of the world with only selected personnel allowed out under a field officer for inspection of the guns and equipment outside the fence. On the 29th of May, my batch of the 22nd received a direct bomb hit on one of the self-propelled 105 howitzers.
Well, excuse me, when did you get those guns? When did you turn in your 25-pounders and receive your FPs?
About 6 months before that.
So you had plenty of time to practice and practice these assault landings firing from the...
All our later exercises were all of the SPs.
Mm-hmm.
And the last... The last month of exercises, they were fully waterproof. So that we part of the exercises was actually going into the water, as if we couldn't get any closer to the beach. And it's quite a sight to see a jeep come off an LCT and all you see is a pipe sticking out of the water. You can't see the driver because he's still underwater before he can get out onto the beach. He'd have to hold his breath until he gets ashore.
Well, how deep was the water that you'd drop off the end of the ramp into?
We went into as much as 8 feet of water in our exercises.
Must have been a heck of a crash inside driving one of the...
The
priest into that...
No, the
bottom?
Well, the LCT doors, which the... were specially fitted so that we could let them down and become a ramp into almost 6 feet of water.
Oh, I see.
So that it wasn't much of a drop.
No.
I'd say the most drop you'd get would be 2 feet.
Oh, well, that wasn't bad.
No.
That wasn't bad then.
No.
Yeah.
And you must remember there's still a buoyancy of water to offset some of that.
Yeah.
Even though a tank is very heavy, it's still
at some point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tell me, how did you find firing with these SPs as compared to your 25-pounders, which were towed? When you came in a LCT, easier to fire, more difficult?
The 105 Priest, the American gun, mounted on the Sherman tank, was a much, much, much better gun than the 25-pounder. It had a longer range, a heavier shell. We could fire it almost as fast, the 25-pounder, but not as fast. But it's more effective.
Mm-hmm.
It had more variety of ammunition. It had smoke. That is the phosphor smoke. It had colored smoke. It had the armor-piercing hollow charge shell, which is much more devastating than the 25-pounder hard shell, you know.
The solid shell. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The
in actual practice, when you came in, was the accuracy improved?
The accuracy was improved. Definite.
It was.
Oh yes, very definite.
You attribute this to the steadier base?
Much steadier base, yeah.
Yeah.
It's absolutely steady. It didn't move one solitary inch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was just part of the ship.
There was enough mass in that SP
itself. Mm-hmm. We also had shackles to hold them from slipping sideways. That was a problem on the tracks on the steel deck. Because we had steel tracks. For action, we used the rubber tracks during the practice season to keep so we didn't tear up the British roads.
Yeah.
But
was your accuracy better? I mean, were you better than your 300-yard?
Yes, it was more accurate because first of all, with the 105 has seven charges,
mm-hmm.
as against three for the 25-pounder, so that you could get a closer comparable charge for your various ranges, so that the tilt of your gun was better for the particular range, for extreme ranges and shorter ranges.
And did you practice in different degrees of sea?
All types, night, daytime, heavy seas,
mm-hmm.
calm.
I imagine heavy seas were a bit of a problem in getting anything very accurate. You couldn't compensate very well for
we could
the
compensate.
Role of the ship.
No, when we first started out, it was difficult. But it's a question of strictly training the concentration of the gun layer had to be absolute. No, you couldn't allow anybody on that gun who wasn't capable of absolute concentration so that he didn't fire unless the bubbles were absolutely level.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the two bubbles, one for forward and up and down, and for lateral sway.
For pitch, yeah.
And
roll. So that was something cooked up especially for this kind of firing, wasn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And we had new equipment, too. We had the Vickers clock, which, the new one, which closes according to the speed of the LCT going towards the shore. And setting this at that speed, it gives the range all
mm-hmm.
the time that the LCT is from the target.
Huh.
So there's no calculation required. The only corrections that are made would be for line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this was controlled by the fire control officer, who was communicated with the shore officers, who had already landed.
Mm-hmm. You know, had the Navy participated in the development of this particular little piece of equipment?
None whatever. No, it was strictly Army.
Yeah.
I would say that the Ordnance Corps and the artillery were the ones who perfected it.
Yeah.
And some of the backroom boys, of course.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting, yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, sir.
This bombing of my battery, we lost quite a bit of equipment. The men on duty acted with great speed, courage, and determination to control the conflagration and the explosions. In addition, we had to evacuate the houses in the small village and keep them from burning up. One motorcycle was found 800 yards away from where it had been parked.
Why?
The losses were two Sherman tanks, four self-propelled guns, a jeep, and three motorcycles. No one was killed or seriously injured. Baker Troop was out of action. Able Troop's damage was made up from what was left of Baker Troop. Detailed plans for such an eventuality had been made, not to our particular knowledge. But that same night, a Brigadier Royal Artillery and an ordnance officer arrived, and Baker Troop's all drivers and gunners were spirited away. On June 1st, they reappeared with all new guns, vehicles, and equipment ready and raring to go.
Huh. That was quick work, wasn't it?
It was, because they had to waterproof. The waterproofing of the guns was complete, but not to the height originally done. Nor was the armored protection on the guns as adequate. In the event, all went well. It was on this day, the 1st of June 1944, that the 12th, 13th Artillery Group moved out into the Solent and steamed to its allotted place in Southampton waters to await the signal to cross the channel. The weather was bad, but late in the afternoon of June the 5th, the fateful code word came through and the second front was on. I was fire control officer and was in a special motor launch with the latest in radar and position fixing equipment. As we sailed out, I set a record going, playing over our loudspeaker the artillery quick march, the Grenadiers, and we passed in and out among the gun LCTs. Then at the head of the column, we headed out to the ships of the Royal Navy at saluting stations as we sailed past. It was a terrible night of heavy seas and gale force winds. We lost a propeller on the motor launch due to having to stern up in the air half of the time. The LCTs were all able to keep approximate stations throughout the night.
I'm W.S. Thackeray. I'm interviewing Lieutenant Colonel J.D. Baird. It's the 27th of May, 1980. Okay, sir.
At this point, I should tell you that a detailed list had been drawn up and approved by the CRAC, showing those who would replace officers who had become casualties in the first week of action. Regimental headquarters also had prepared a list approved by the field officers of the regiment, covering the same, in the same respect, in regard to NCOs. In my particular case, I was to replace the officer commanding or the second in command. In the event, I became second in command of the regiment on D-Day. The assault force of the regiment represented about 75% of the strength. The remaining 25% were to come in after HR, some in fact up to 2 weeks later. Dawn on D-Day was cold and gray with poor visibility. The wind had dropped to almost zero and the waves had subsided to manageable proportions. HR had been postponed 10 minutes to allow some essential craft to close up. The prearranged range to open fire had been 9,000 yards. In the event, due to urgent appeals from our officers with the assault infantry, I ordered our right front craft, B Troop, to open ranging fire by troop salvo at 14,000 yards. These rounds were observed and I ordered the necessary line and range corrections. Thus, we were able to go into full fire with effect at 11,000 yards. Rapid fire was continued to a closing range of 5,000 yards, at which time the leading LCTs were within 2,000 yards of the beach. I ordered empty guns, and we swung about, heading back to sea to await orders to land and deploy. I should mention that in addition to the guns, I had control over two LCTs, each loaded with about 1,000 Typhoon rockets, pre-adjusted for a specified range. By a combination of radar and the ranging of our guns, the leading LCT, I determined the moment when to order fire for the rocket craft. We learned later that the blanket effect of these rockets on the German defenses on the beach approaches was devastating. They had a special radio frequency for contact with the naval forces enabling our forward observing officers to call for fire on strong points and also for high explosive on enemy concentrations. During D-Day, the Royal Navy was informed by the neutralization of the Scharnhorst in the Reichstag, and they informed us that all their ammunition was available to the last round. The German artillery opened fire while we were awaiting orders to land, and two of our LCTs were hit. The 12th Field had priority to land and deployed on the beach, making it impossible for the 13th to deploy. Our role was direct support for the Regina rifles, so I ordered the 44th Battery to use an alternative beach and to get some guns ashore as soon as possible. By noon, this was accomplished, with a battery deployed several hundred yards from the beach and going into action. We were very lucky on D-Day, as our casualties were only 8 killed and 9 wounded. By late afternoon, all guns were deployed and in action on either side of the road near Banville, within sight of the coast, a little over a mile inland. By nightfall, the Reginas had almost reached their objective of cutting the Bay-Yukon Highway. It was achieved the next morning. The first night on shore was a nightmare. The Luftwaffe was out busily bombing and strafing all night long. Considerable enemy artillery harassing fire was experienced. Our arc of fire on D plus one was 340 degrees. Our regimental sergeant major, a first war veteran, could not adjust to it. He broke down and had to be evacuated. The situation on D plus one was so critical, it was necessary for me to form all those not required for the guns into a combat group to defend our flanks. We were firing at all angles, even back onto the beach, not yet fully secured between the assault divisions. From D-Day until the capture of Caen, the regiment occupied 13 gun positions and fought continuously day and night for 55 days. On July 30th, on the far side of Caen, we were relieved by the 4th Canadian Army Division, and we went to a refitting area near Bayeux, where we turned in our 105 SPs for 25-pounder field guns.
What was the reason for that, may I interrupt?
The reason was that our SPs were to be converted to armored personnel carriers.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Nicknamed Kangaroos, and our drivers went with them. They served with the 51st Highland Division on Exercise Totalized, which we nicknamed the Nightmare Offensive.
I'm going to ask the question. was a complete troop in a landing craft?
A landing craft tank.
Yeah, LFT.
There were four guns, all the necessary radios, jeeps, and required to keep that gun in action, and the men, of course, indefinitely.
Was there a blast effect from your on your forward guns from the ones firing from behind, or was that a problem? Or what was
we had problems when we first started this scheme of firing from the sea, when we were using 25-pounders up in Inverary. But after we got the 105, which stands quite high, the gun barrel is quite high up, we had no problems at all. And you must remember this. The 105 has seven charges. Mm-hmm. Therefore, when you're extreme range, of course, there's more blast. But as you approach the shore, your blast gets less and less because you begin to reduce your charges. But we had no problems at all. The men, of course, all wore earplugs. But we didn't have any damage to radio equipment of any kind.
I understand the effect of the fire was more demoralizing than it was actually damaging to the fixed defenses, particularly.
Well, look.
Perhaps due to the light caliber of the weapons.
That's right. However, it did keep their heads down, and we had very little firing at us on the run-in. It did keep their heads down.
The firing started when you turned away at 2,000 yards, then they popped up again and had a go.
That's right.
I see.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So, is it correct then, from 2,000 yards out, after that time, the assault troops didn't have any artillery support?
Just the naval.
Naval guns.
That's all they had.
I see.
And the Typhoons, the aircraft got very busy then. The Typhoon, as you know, was a Canadian effort. The pilots were all Canadians, and they were the most effective dive bomber that was ever used in the war. They carried, four Typhoon rockets of 80 pounds each, and they could fire two at a time. And our Canadian pilots were exceptionally brave, highly skilled, and furthermore had knew a lot of us, because they used to visit our mess, you know, on the schemes we went to. And I think it was that interrelationship between everybody in a division. For instance, almost every sergeant in our infantry battalions had been out on our guns and had actually fired them. We knew each other by first name basis, and I think that was a wonderful thing, and I think made a big difference on the morale of everybody concerned. But the Typhoons, the Canadians, used to dive right down practically a rooftop before they let them go. Later on, because of the casualties they suffered, we got less experienced or less dedicated pilots, and they used to often loose their bombs at, say, as much as 2,000 feet up, and they hit nothing.
What precisely was the reason that you stopped firing at 2,000 yards? Why did you not continue in? The beach hadn't been secured yet properly?
We had used up all our ammunition.
Oh, had you? The idea was to, what was the basic idea, though? Why not move in closer and support the assault? It's something I was just, you know, curious about.
There's no way that you can support
that close.
You've got no way of independently steering each craft and getting the exact... In other words, you can't fire at a map reference.
No,
it's
just
impossible.
Yeah, and you had, of course, had to steer the boats in order to get the line.
That's
properly,
right.
I see.
Yeah. So all you can do in this setup is lay down a barrage. Now this is what happens: your six LCTs per regiment are deployed in an echelon formation. And each one has a different range.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, when I opened fire at the extreme range I did, the two rear LCTs couldn't open fire because they would have been inaccurate. They would have had to exceed the range I opened fire, the 12,000 yards. But, in other words, everybody fires at the same line on the beach. But each craft has a different range.
Mm-hmm.
Now this they do themselves. It's all geared to the ranging landing craft tank, and the officer in charge of each craft knows his distance from the lead craft. This has been derived after months and months and months of practice. I would like to say one thing. People have asked me on occasion how we could pinpoint ourselves so accurately as to position. I did mention the motor launch I was on was top secret. I wasn't even allowed to see any of the equipment. But I found out later that some commandos had gone in during the night and had put up two radio beacons, at a certain distance apart. And we had a device to get the angle to each of those, giving us an absolute fix. Well, almost absolute. We also had dead reckoning. We had the most sophisticated radar of the time. And as I think I mentioned before, when I opened fire at 12,000, the correction was only about 300 yards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes,
which is phenomenally good.
Yeah. According to the official history, there was a tendency on the part of certainly some of the artillery to overshoot, and was that perhaps due to an inability or a time lag between the orders to decrease range and the actual firing, or what would, just wondered if that had come up in any sort of critique of the operation that you would partake in?
Well, I had discussed this later on with the various infantry people. They would have liked to have had closer support than they claimed they got. However, we were firing at a very rapid rate of fire. We still had waves to contend with, and if we'd tried to get any closer, we would have killed more of them than the Jerrys did.
Mm-hmm.
You must remember that the individual gun layer must balance two bubbles. There's the yaw right and left, or port and starboard, and then the dip fore and aft. And you cannot fire that gun until both those are leveled, because one is range and one is line. I think that we did exceptionally well. We did better than anybody else.
Yeah.
And
I think even the I think the official history, Stacy's book, says that that you did. Certainly much better than the British regiment who was attacked. You, they were all over the map apparently.
I think it was lack of training, and another thing too. I don't think the priest was as good a setup as our 105s, and I don't think the 25 pounder, under the circumstances, because of the only having three charges. In other words, it has a higher muzzle velocity for the particular range than the 105, so that. They had more trouble with their tragic tour than we had. And I quite agree that they did not have the training.
Mm-hmm.
There was nobody went in on D-Day that had the training of the 3rd Canadian Division. And Montgomery himself had said that it was probably the highest trained division that ever went into action.
Oh, okay, we're back on again.
Yeah. You've asked me about the... is whether we supported the Regina Rifles throughout the campaign. We supported the Regina Rifles only on D-Day and probably for a couple of days thereafter. We had a major general who wanted everything neat and tidy. And therefore, even though we had trained for months and months and months with the 7th Brigade, which included the Regina Rifles, and the Canadian Scottish of Victoria, we were switched over to support the 8th Infantry Brigade. So therefore we had 12, 13, 14 field regiments, 7, 8, 9 brigade. Nice, neat, and tidy. And we therefore lost all that wonderful comradeship and knowledge of each other that we'd worked for months, almost years, to obtain. At times, our general was even annoyed if the 13th Field Regiment was on the left of the line instead of the middle. These things don't bother gunners, and it certainly doesn't bother the infantry either. But this is the way things were. Now during that 55 days, we had direct attacks on the gun position by Germans.
Did you?
Infantry.
Mm-hmm. Infiltrated, did they?
Yes, they were on both flanks.
Mm-hmm.
We had one quite a royal battle about D plus 4 when every available person who could be taken off the guns were out on the left flank fighting Jerrys and sending them back out of the way. In fact, I had to fire the guns almost as mortars at this stage of the game because we had the 3rd British Division on our left, but the Jerrys were in between us right down to the coast. And I remember one time I had to order That's charge two. So that I could fire up over some farmhouses and drop them in behind as like mortars. And that's the one thing you can do with a 105, which you cannot do with a 25 pounder.
What was the range there? About 1,500 yards and that sort of thing?
No, it'd be about a, not more than 1,000.
Not many thousand. That close.
Yep. Yeah. And later on, when we got up to Bretteville, which was our final objective, on the D plus one, we had we were attacked by two Tiger tanks, one of them getting into the gun position, but we were able to disperse them. We had the hollow charge, it was one thing that the Jerry couldn't stand. He was terrified of it, because one hit anywhere on a tank, it's finished, particularly when it's a 36-pound hollow charge. Piet, you know, what to the infantry personnel, anti-tank weapon is only a, well, you put the bomb in your hand, practically.
Yes, but not very big.
No, and it'll knock a track off a tank. You can imagine what ours would do. We experimented with our 105s while we were at Lark Hill one time, and we had Churchill tank at a distance of, well, I think it'd be about 2,000 yards. And we ranged on it with HE quickly, and then shot a hollow charge round, and it went right through the side and gutted the entire inside of a Churchill tank, which was the heaviest armored tank there was. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very powerful weapon.
You relied, in this particular weapon, then, or method of firing the guns, you relied on the fact that it was a hollow charge rather than high velocity to achieve your
could just drop it on it, would be...
Oh, really? Yeah.
For instance, you could fire it as a mortar if you wanted to, and go up and down just and drop on
the top.
On top, it'd be just as effective as a more effective, matter of fact, because if you fire a hollow charge with an extreme charge, that is a high speed charge, you can defeat the objective of a hollow charge. In other words, you shatter the effect of it.
It's moving too fast, and the nose collapses before it has the time to proper use.
And disperses the concentration that's expected.
Yeah. Huh. So this must have been a pretty exciting time then, when you had tanks running around.
Well, it was very so, and of course there was. As you know, we could not outrange the German 88mm, and we had quite a few shells in the gun position. From 88, so we couldn't, nobody...